Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. This week's episode of Screen Talk is sponsored by Blue Fox Entertainment's My Zoe, the emotional and complex new film from Julie Delpy. In My Zoe, Delpy plays Isabel, a brilliant scientist who co-parents with her ex, their beloved young daughter, Zoe. But when a sudden accident leaves Zoe near death, Isabel finds herself pushing the boundaries of science and ethics to find a way to keep Zoe alive. My Zoe is a fascinating hybrid of drama and science fiction, with an exploration of the unlimited power of a mother's love that is bound to leave audiences talking. Critics rave about the film and its issues. IndieWire wrote, "By the time the screen goes black one final time, Delpy has left enough to think about for another three acts." My Zoe also features brilliant performances from Daniel Brühl, Gemma Arterton, and Richard Armitage. Opens February 26th. Listings are at myzoemovie.com. Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large, for our Golden Globes preview discussion. And it's one of those things where just when you think you've said everything there is to say about the Globes, along comes another expose to remind you that the HFPA is maybe not the most ethically scrupulous. That's the word I'm looking for.
They are very scrutinized. They're sure.
The most ethically scrutinized, for good reason, perhaps, organization out there. And honestly, these revelations about, I don't know what to say, bribes and all the other kind of stuff, it's not that they're surprising. It's that they never cease to amaze me, and I'm sure many other people, because this thing commands so much attention, and everyone's going to pay attention on Sunday anyway. Doesn't matter. How do we get to the point where any of this stuff actually affects the organization?
I think the question is, that's a really good way of putting it, Eric, because the question is, there's a Golden Globes show that everybody, you know, knows and some people love and some people take more seriously than others. There's a difference between being inside the industry and inside the awards ecosystem and recognizing full well exactly who these people are. We know them. They are not respected journalists.
Well, we don't really know them. I mean,
we do. Well, people in LA know them, and some of them are more reputable than others, and some of them are profoundly disreputable. But it's a question of the people who there was a tweet by Linda Obst, the producer, and she made movies like Contact and she's a legit producer, and she was sort of reassuring the Hollywood Foreign Press that she loves them and she cares about them and she wants to continue working with them. And why would she do that? All right, because everyone in Hollywood who is promoting something and is aiming at the Oscars in the end, which is the end goal, they want to use the Golden Globes to get there. They want to get a win. They want to get a nomination. They want to get something they can put in an ad. It's all about that. And so they work these people, and they work them in the same way that they work everyone. In other words, if you're a movie star, if you're Joss Whedon, how did Joss Whedon turn from an upstanding citizen into someone who has turned out to be some kind of toxic boss, serial womanizer, if not sexual harasser? I mean, we don't know what he's actually done, but he's been accused of a lot of things. What in fact, you know, is the reason that could ever happen to someone who started out life as an upstanding citizen? It's because Hollywood blows smoke at all these people. It makes them think they're fabulous. It makes them think that they're all God's gift. Even the people on the foreign committee of the Academy, which is no longer as much a thing because it's become expanded and people from all over the world can now participate in the picking of the international films. That group because there was such a small number of people who had undue influence on voting for best foreign language film back in the day, they were wined and dined. The Critics' Choice Awards, which you and I are both members of, there has been a noticeable increase in the amount of swag and the stuff that gets sent and the ways that they try to get you to look at their movie.
Well, and I think also that you have to look at the nature of the membership that's being swayed here. And there's a distinction between the Hollywood figure who has so many different options and perhaps gets more streetwise as a result and can tell when someone is you know, BSing them with a lot of praise so that they can get a result. And
somebody they can't always tell, Eric.
Well, but obviously not everybody can tell. When you're in it, it's really hard to discern and people have to learn. It's part of the process. But what about somebody who the BS is all you have? You know, if you're a journalist who doesn't have a lot of money and power, then getting swag in the mail or being invited to special events, that is the sole source of your power. So being a card-carrying member of the HFPA, it's not like a bonus. It ends up being the thing you have going for yourself. And that's why
I know. And that's the real problem is that there's so few of them. And I am truly disturbed by the idea that they are protecting their territory and not allowing other people to become members of the organization. They could have really helped themselves a lot if they had gotten bigger and more inclusive in every way. There are basically no Black people in this organization. And they're really insular and they were fighting for their perks and fighting for their territory. So that somebody, if there was a person who represented Holland, they didn't want another person who represented Holland, you know, who would compete with them.
Like the UN.
The stories. That's where they get in. That's where I go, yo. And also, you know, I would say to you that there are many.
Yo, something is up.
There's many, many, many journalists, so-called. I would suggest that that's a word that we have to use judiciously. There are many people in the media who are invited to junkets. I mean, the junket thing happens across the media. It's not just the hot. They get the really good ones, obviously. And eventually they started to pay their own travel. And eventually, at each turn that they've been accused, the Pia Zadora thing is like 30 years old at this point. You know, it's like enough already. But they've been trying to improve all these years. They started, it's true, they really did start as from a point of scarcity when they couldn't get arrested. They couldn't get access. And so they banded together to get access and they came up with this awards thing, and it grew and grew and grew and grew over the years. But the truth of the matter is, Eric, that no one respects the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, and no one takes the Golden Globe seriously, even in, at least not inside Hollywood.
And yet there's, I mean, we'll see what the virtual-ish ceremony looks like this weekend, but it commands a lot of attention, not only because of the benefit that from different people's campaigns, but because it generally makes for good TV to have all these famous people in the room.
Of course.
It's like, if you could swap out the HFPA for another organization that voted on these movies, you could still have a good show and just call it
the Critics' Globe. Choice Awards has their own show. It's actually a rival, it's very much smaller, but let me suggest to you that the show, I'm very curious to see what that show is going to look like, because you're absolutely right. It's all those people clustered together, having dinner, drinking, having fun. That's not
Oprah
gonna
in
be
the
there.
Front row the whole time or whatever. Yeah, you start.
You want to look at those people talking to each other in reaction shots, and that's what it's all about. And you know, what the occasional grimace. I mean, that's the fun part. And if someone stumbles on the way to the stage, that's the fun part too.
Or like Emma Stone shouting out, "I'm sorry" about Aloha in the middle of something else happening on stage.
Or Christine Lottie caught in the bathroom. You know, it's what it's about. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. And I think that they can be counted on to deliver the right tone. It's an interesting year to have such a frivolous award show, you know?
Yeah,
we'll see.
It's an interesting year for anything frivolous. And the very concept of being frivolous has been challenged by the past year and change. But we'll see. Maybe it'll be a welcome sort of sense of levity in that respect too. And we'll go through the categories now. It's certainly possible that there could be some very powerful speeches from some of these winners. Or
Sacha Baron Cohen is the one I'm looking forward to because he's up for 3 awards and he could win at least 1, if not 2. I think he'll win 2. And I think we can count on him to really deliver some power. You know, the famous Meryl Streep speech. He's political too. And he's up for 2 different films. So, The Trial of the Chicago 7 and Borat. That's the key.
Yeah, having Chicago 7 and Borat together is sort of like this holy combo of sorts. I mean, he was the one guy of all the gazillion reactions to Globe nominations. He seemed to kind of go viral with his response when he said, like, he'd hire Giuliani to defend him if he lost or something like that. So I'm sure he'll have some good material like that. And, you know, meanwhile, a quiet little movie like Nomadland will be sitting there so we can sort of speculate about what this all means about momentum, because you seem to be predicting it's going to be a big night for Chicago 7. If anybody stands...
And Borat, those two.
It's going to be Borat and Chicago 7.
And maybe Leslie Odom Jr. will get more than one. He could get supporting actor and song. Now, it's an interesting question. I put out my predictions. I'm never confident, by the way. I am never confident about my predictions. They're pretty much in line with what the standard issue predictions are. I didn't take any great risks because I went with Chadwick Boseman over Anthony Hopkins, which, you know, we'll see how that plays out. Part of what goes on is that there's a kind of momentum that comes with the new movies that are opening. So The Father is opening. Nomadland is relatively new. More people are seeing them. So there's a certain momentum for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's going to be fascinating to see where the upsets lie. And remember last year, I don't think everybody expected 1917 to do what it did at the end of the
season. I checked my predictions and I did predict 1917 for the Globes.
But that one I do remember it registered as a surprise by and large to people.
And Hollywood, remember Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was on the comedy side. So that, mm-hmm. and Bong Joon-ho's Parasite was in foreign language. So that's why it all went down, you know, a different way.
But even then it was like so hard to imagine what Parasite would do, even though it was in the cards, you know, with the WGA and the SAG and all that kind of stuff. So it was like, oh, maybe this is the obvious inevitable endpoint is 1917 on stage at the end of the night, just like the Oscars in a couple of weeks. But
yes, but the point here is that the Golden Globes is this weird group of 87 people. It doesn't reflect the Academy at all. So all it does is add momentum to a movie and give it a bit of a boost.
Right.
It's not predictive.
But it puts those movies on the stage and the spotlight in a way where they can actually speak to voters. So in a year where you can't have in-person.
But winning a Globe doesn't mean, you know, for example, I've been thinking that maybe the fact that the Five Bloods was shut out would maybe the Academy would rise to its defense in some way. Or if, for example, Nomadland doesn't win, drama, and it goes to trial of the Chicago 7. In a weird reverse way, the Globes picked Chicago 7. Of course they picked the entertaining movie, right? The serious movie is the one that the Academy can support.
Right.
You see, there is a way to think about that.
That is the potential split. I think if anything, we're going to see confirmation of certain Oscar heavyweights. The trial Nomadland split is fascinating. I mean, I don't dislike either of those movies. I'm obviously more in the Nomadland camp, but I do think it is fascinating to think about one feeling sort of like a bit of an old school rah-rah ensemble period piece and the other being this more kind of, you know, experimental study of, you know, real people in American society. It's like, that I love those that kind of divide, and that's going to be really fascinating to talk about, especially once we get to the other side of the globes and the narrative kind of gets more momentum going. In terms of the other categories, I don't know what's really going to, what could possibly change. I mean, you know, for example, like with Best Actor, I mean, presumably Chadwick Boseman's, is it his widow? Somebody's going to give a really powerful speech if he wins that.
I don't think they can go against that narrative. And the other thing that's weighing on them right now in this period when they're under so much attack, and they're in a defensive mode, they've gotten a lot of criticism for being less than inclusive. There are several categories that are very white, including the motion picture drama category. And I think they're going to I have to assume that they almost had a Golden Globe So White last year. Awkwafina saved them to a degree. They really need to worry about that. They could have an Oscar so a Golden Globe So White this year easily.
Do they care? I mean, if it
they what, care what, about what all the they? Attacks that they've been getting. They do. They operate on their own. I mean, each of them is they're not consulting with each other necessarily about how they fill out their ballots. There is no operating system to protect them from that happening. If everybody votes for Carrie Mulligan for Best Actress, and everybody votes for Anthony Hopkins for Best Actor, and everybody, you know, it could happen.
And they don't have rules like the Academy has tried every which way to kind of basically figure out, okay, everybody's going to vote and the results are the results, but we're going to create rules here. We're going to create a committee there. We're going to do all these things and bring in new members. And that's where the change comes in.
So the Globes haven't done anything to modernize. They haven't done anything to expand their membership. As I said before, they have made it worse for themselves in a big way. But they also tend to have more mainstream taste than the Academy, and they tend to. So Nomadland is a fascinating case where it's just one of my favorite movies of the year and very moving to me. And I would give the Oscar to Frances McDormand in a heartbeat. Let her have three Oscars. It's fine by me. She's just extraordinary to me, you know.
And the story of the performance is really remarkable, and there's no real backlash. I think I've said this before, but it's like you could see a backlash if someone were to say that, you know, it's like this rich Hollywood person pretending to be, you know.
No, that story in the New York Times that Kyle Buchanan did, you know, reveals that it was a really good story for her because it shows how hard she's trying to live a normal life. I remember Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. Now, they lived in Darien, Connecticut, or Westport, I forgot which one, but you know, it was obviously a New England enclave, but they were allowed, you know, they were allowed to live normal lives as stars, and they did.
You know, it's been a fascinating narrative, I think, in the last few weeks is Promising Young Woman. If Carey Mulligan wins for Best Actress in Drama, and I could have seen a world where somebody might have submitted that movie for comedy, and there would have been a whole complex conversation.
They submitted it for comedy. And it was put in for drama. That's what they did.
Oh, see, this is why I don't do what you do. And so this is a really important point of clarity. So it's up to the HFPA to make that.
They decide. Yeah. This has happened many times. The Martian was deemed to be a comedy.
But Get Out was submitted as a comedy, and that's how they accepted it. And I remember there was a whole. People
There's
didn't
always
understand
debate.
That at first. And, yeah, but I mean, because this one, it's very interesting. If it had been seen as a comedy, it would have been a very different situation. But she is in this category alongside Viola Davis, who may be a Best Actress Oscar frontrunner alongside Frances McDormand. But in this case, you're saying Carey Mulligan stands a really good shot with the HFPA. And I think that's fascinating because that's a movie that seems to have more recently developed a very robust fan base.
It's popular, man. Everybody likes this movie except me. No. I actually always admired Carey Mulligan's performance, so I'm totally fine with anything that goes on there. I love the screenplay. I always had some issues with the directing, but the Golden Globes, they gave it all of those things.
I have to say, I was late on this one, much later than I care to admit. I wish I had seen it at Sundance and been able to kind of debate it with you and other people, because I think what's fascinating about it is that it's so unpredictable. It's willing to do things tonally with the subject matter of sexual abuse and all these other kinds of really dark issues that come up, but also do them in a way that's sort of subversive, that allows her performance to kind of keep you guessing. And I just thought, even though you're right, sometimes the direction is uneven, there's something about the riskiness of the storytelling that you don't usually see on a film of this scale. And I was really drawn into that all the way through to the end. And that's
so you could see, a lot of people are very impressed by what Emerald Fennell did. A lot of people are, and I could see them. I think Aaron Sorkin wins screenplay. You know that they put all the comedies and dramas into one category. So Emerald Fennell is up for both director and screenplay. She took a, those are hard slots to get. That's a sign of strength. So the Promising Young Woman has to win something. So suppose Viola Davis wins actress. I could imagine Promising Young Woman winning screenplay, but they're going to give it to Sorkin. They have to give it to Sorkin.
Right. I mean, it just seems like one of those things where there's probably a couple of people who didn't even see the movie who will vote. I mean, it's just, that's the superstar, right? But
the other question about momentum that's sort of interesting is how, what I was saying before, I mean, Judas and the Black Messiah, they saw that earlier than a lot of other people, and they gave it a couple of nominations for song and for supporting actor for Daniel Kaluuya. What if he's the one who wins over Leslie Odom Jr.? That's a big, I could see that actually happening at the BAFTAs. I could see it happening at the Oscars. But for now, I'm going to say the momentum is going to go to where I thought the race was a few weeks ago, which is Amanda Seyfried for supporting actors for Mank, because that got 6 nominations, and this, it has to win something, I think.
We've talked before about the kind of the subtle nature of Netflix's campaign for this movie that divided critics, got largely shut out of critics' awards, and yet has continued to churn along with support that suggests a fairly sturdy Academy interest in the movie. And She is the strongest aspect in many, for a lot of people. I mean, it's one of her best performances.
It's the best she's ever given. And she holds her own with Gary Oldman, which is hard to do, I think. But the SAG people didn't seem to think so.
Yeah, and the SAG was not. But there was a whole thing about their age that didn't really stick, the age difference between them. And so that there's a resilience there. And obviously, again, she benefits from not being up against Maria Bakalova, who is sort of
she'll win.
And then you have this thing with Glenn Close and Olivia Colman rematch, which I'm surprised that's not gaining as much traction. That's a great, fun drama.
So Bakalova's over. The way that they broke it down is Bakalova is musical or comedy best actress.
Actress, yes.
So she's not competing against the supporting actresses who are not divided by musical, comedy, or drama.
And I have to say, it's confusing. Best actress, musical, or comedy, that's a pretty weird, funky category this year. I mean, that's where they get Kate Hudson
for music.
Yeah, I don't
Michelle
even know.
Rosamund Pike is actually very good in I Care a Lot, but it's hardly an awards movie, really.
Rosamund Pike is always worth talking about, though. And Anya Taylor-Joy, she certainly had quite a year on the heels of Queen's Gambit to enter an awards conversation for Emma.
So they're going to probably give it to her for Queen's Gambit. That's their option.
So she doesn't have to win
in this category.
Yeah. But it would be...
So they're voting for TV and film.
if she gets it for both, that'll be a hell of a thing, because she is sort of the one of the bigger rising stars to just enter a new stage over the past year. I mean, you know, I thought she was great in The Witch, and we follow these people for a while, but there's always that moment where all of a sudden it's like they cross over, and this feels like that's that crossover moment. Bakalova, it's like she was just like pure discovery, but she's in a category that just seems to really favor her in this particular situation.
Yeah, I don't see how you, I mean, it's always about a narrative, and the Bulgarian actress landing this role and running with it the way she did is hard for the Hollywood foreign press to deny, I suggest.
So all this time, and we haven't talked about the potential upset of Hamilton, which nobody seems to totally understand, but there it is.
I think the fact that Hamilton is not eligible for the Oscars and it's a filmed play is still a problem, unless they feel that they need to go in the direction of a hugely popular movie. So I don't know. I don't know if they. I don't feel it.
What are you honoring here? It's like, to me, it's like it's a documentary of the stage production, a category that is woefully neglected by this particular award ceremony, and yet seems to be acknowledged here for things that are about its documentary production, how somebody enters into an existing stage dynamic and films it. But fine, whatever, it's there. I did quite enjoy revisiting the show with the original players and all that kind of stuff. So I wonder what sort of precedent this might set, you know, the next time we get a filmed version of a popular Broadway show that does very well on a streaming platform, because those aren't going to go away either. They're going to be worth a lot of money, especially with the whole question of when Broadway's reopening continuing to be a whole thing. Maybe we should talk a bit about the nature of things reopening before we call it quits.
Yeah,
today.
So you guys in New York are going to get there before we do.
Apparently, New York theaters are going to open next week, just after the moment in time where it would be relevant in an Oscar qualifying window of sorts. Not that that matters this year, but it's just a funny moment. However, we do know from various sources that a lot of these smaller independent theaters, whether it's Film Forum or MoMA or Lincoln Center, are not just going to jump in and reopen at 25 reduced capacity, especially when you can't get your staff vaccinated, because unlike wait staff in a wet restaurant, they don't qualify for a vaccine. So it you operate at a loss when you open at 25% capacity,
yeah,
and you don't have a lot of capacity, and you can't protect your staff. So nobody really benefits from doing that. But the bigger chains are going to go hard on this. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see just, I mean, in the city, I have to tell you, it still feels like things have been a little dead. I mean, it's quieter there. You can go to busy, fine city streets that are busy, but do people want to go sit inside in a movie theater in a way that feels like it might be a gray area? I personally don't feel like we're there yet when only 500,000 people are fully vaccinated in the city of 8 million. So I think it's
so
not
Tom Bernard of Sony Pictures Classics was talking to me the other day about how, oh, well, it's the old folks that are vaccinated that are going to return to the art houses in droves. And I somehow doubt that, but it's an interesting theory.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it means in the sense that returning in droves, you know, these are habits that, I mean, certainly, you know, they don't just go away, but you also need to feel the imperative to bring them back. I mean, it's one thing to go sit in a restaurant because there's something easy and relaxing about it, but going to see a movie, that's a very complex kind of cultural habit. You know, reading the newspaper, getting the review, feeling like this is worth your time, finding a place that's close enough to you, and then sitting through it. I mean, it's sort of a contingent on a whole set of variables that are not a given right now. So we might be there at a certain point. I mean, every day I open up the Times, and I read different things about, you know, this vaccine is more effective than that vaccine and this variant and that variant and all this kind of stuff. So I do feel like there's going to be this sort of touch and go situation where people are going, we're moving in a positive direction. There's no question about that. You can sense that. But also people are more hesitant than ever before to trust the climate. So that's really going to be the open open area of sorts, where I hope that the theaters can find a way to come back bit by bit and experiment. And maybe there are going to be some people who can, you know, do one-off kinds of events and see how it goes. But the idea of just, you know, opening your doors, it just doesn't seem.
And some of them aren't. Some of them are going to, I mean, film at Lincoln Center is going to wait a bit and, you know, hold off until it makes financial sense for them, until they have enough product. I mean, that's the other thing. So we're going to slowly see the whole system, you know, right itself, so that there's movies going out and places to show them. But we're also getting lots of indications of the theaters that are shutting down. And we knew that was going to happen, that there would be some attrition, and that the circuits already under duress would let go of some of their weaker houses. So there's going to be fewer theaters in the end.
When and if these entities reopen, they are reopening in a fundamentally changed climate for exhibition. This past week, we also heard from Paramount Plus and how they're going to put Mission Impossible on the streaming platform 45 days after its theatrical. So 45 days is the new window. It's a totally different, they're not going to say oops once all the theaters come back in 6 months and go back to the old way.
No, they're not. And I would say to you that Universal had a 17-day window. That's before PVOD. You know, that's what that window is. And then there's Warner Brothers did this day and date thing. You know, that was one set of a model, that one model for people to follow. This is a more likely model for people to follow, I would suggest. This could be the standard for the entire industry. Mr. Jim Giannopoulos, the head of Paramount, is very respected and someone who's regarded as a kind of mediator, you know, and leader for the industry. And I think they will pay attention to this, and exhibition will maybe recognize that they can't go back any farther than this.
It's going to be a fascinating sort of resettling. I can't believe that, you know, we spent 2, 3, 4 years, what was it, anticipating the quote-unquote streaming wars. Nobody anticipated the phase that we would enter into in which all these studios would rush to suddenly be a part of it. I mean, it's even there were some folks who were doing it faster than others, but now it's like
that's all, right.
It's
right.
Environment. So next week, I guess we'll see what
next
happens.
Week we have a guest. We have to tell everybody about our guest.
Oh yeah, why don't you reveal our guest?
Our guest is Tom Quinn, who is the CEO of Neon, and of course that's the company that released Parasite last year. And they have a roster of movies on the documentary side, on the foreign language side, all sorts of things to discuss about this year. And we look forward to having him.
Yeah, we haven't done a live one in a bit, not since the start of the year. And I think Tom's a great guest for this stage because we've known him a long time. I remember when he was, you know, at Magnolia and working on some really cool, edgy stuff that a lot of people didn't understand the market for, like Let the Right One In or things like that. You know, pushing genre filmmaking to a whole new level. In a way.
And digital releasing through Radius at the Weinstein Co.
And moving from Magnolia doing that to figuring out how to build it from the ground up, forging a relationship with Bong Joon-ho, the kind of multi-year plan to make that a filmmaker who could actually resonate, you know, across this industry, and then understanding that Parasite really could go all the way. I mean, this is not BS. This is like genuine advocacy. It's not just being a smart industry person, it's being somebody who actually cares about a certain kind
he
of
he takes
movie
chances
movie. Yeah,
he loves movies.
So I think it's fun, and we'll have info out for how people can sign up to listen to this conversation and submit questions. So if, you know, it feels like we're not getting to the right ones, you can play a role in this too. So we hope that people tune in, and I think it's a good time for us to, we spend so much time just in an echo chamber, so it's always fun. We can bring in a third voice. So so I'm excited about this one. But enjoy the Globes, Anne. I'm sure we'll be chatting online and snarking away, and we'll see
of
what
course.
Happens.
Of course. What Have are the Globes weekend. Without snark? All right.
Yeah.
Bye-bye, darling.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.